people pissing. Views and opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees.
Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge.
Hey, good afternoon, Orlando, and welcome to another edition of Pumpanomics, broadcasting live directly from WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, the best in big mad radio.
The very best.
The very best. And that was Dr. Benjamin Ballack. We have Corey Carroll, also on the other mic, and Jose Garvez, and my name is Jesse Velez.
Hello, everybody.
Yeah, welcome to Pumpanomics.
Yes. All right. I'm catching my breath a little bit because I'm in a good mood because I just shared some of my gamified pedagogy with fellow faculty and IT people in kind of a little thing we have going, kind of luncheons where we share teaching methodologies and etc. And I had a lot of people come and they asked really interesting questions, and so I had a good time.
Why don't you tell everybody what the whole gamification is? Huh?
It's true that it's been a while now. I'm kind of already thinking of doing, and we did a couple of shows actually as the, yeah, we've been on the air now. What I just posted, the one you sent me was 120 with, wow, Avi. So this would be 121.
121 shows.
And I'm not counting 2 hours as two, right?
Counting two hours
as one. It's part one, part two. Anybody actually listens to us for a full time?
Sounds like syndication to me, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it is real simple syndication, RSS, right? That's a big invention. That's another story. So yeah, we'll dedicate a little. We have before, we'll do it again. We'll set something up like that. But today we have,
I just have like a couple general talking points.
Yeah, excellent.
Come in for a few weeks.
Absolutely.
The IMF issued a somewhat ironic warning today that advanced economies are stuck in a spiral of slowing growth, low inflation, and rising debt. It's kind of like, oh, thank you for the...
Really?
Thank you for informing us.
Yeah, I mean,
So how long, according to them, this has been going on?
Well, the way they stated it, they made it seem like they just came to that conclusion.
They just arrived to that conclusion.
They just arrived to that. It's almost like, you know, they're...
That's good monitoring, eh?
I mean, I don't know what the denial time cycle looks like for them, but apparently it's pretty long.
Yeah,
know?
Man, I think, well, that's a nice cycle to study in economics, I think.
There is a, I read a lot of...
The denial cycle?
I read a lot of Zero Hedge because of, I feel like being depressed before I go to sleep at night. And
cool kind of depressing sort of way.
You like to cry yourself to sleep.
You know what's interesting?
You keyed me into that, by the way, yeah. Corey, back in the day.
It's interesting because of, they actually bring out a lot of people who work in finance. They bring out analysts from like Societe Generale. They bring out people from Goldman Sachs, right? So these are people who have a vested interest in the status quo, if you will, and often they have views that conflict with the status quo. They had something from SocGen this past week where the analyst basically called out the ECB and the Federal Reserve, saying that we've entered into just pure Ponzi finance, because what the ECB more or less openly last week told...
European Central Bank.
Yeah. They more or less openly told publicly traded European companies to issue bonds, junk, more or less unsecured bonds, and then buy back their own stock with them, just to prop up their own stock.
How is this related? And now I'm just following my curiosity. I've been really in a bubble for a couple of weeks, literally, working, kind of disconnected. One of the things that made it through my bubble was that it seemed like the ECB, the European Central Bank, has basically reversed its horrific long-term strategy of austerity.
Oh yeah, no. Mario Draghi is 180. Yeah, yeah.
How does that link to what you were just telling us?
Well, I mean, now the ECB, instead of pursuing which by the way, Germany doesn't want the ECB to do what they're doing. The ECB is just kind of acting on its own at the behest of everyone else in the European Union. I want to say that their quantitative easing program is running 120 billion euros a month. So, I mean, that's huge. That's way larger than what we ran here in the U.S. during our QE program, and it's open-ended. I mean, there is no...
Though we didn't experience the kind of hard right-wing austerity. A lot of people still think that Western Europe is like, you know, a socialist paradise or hell, depending on your position. But it's not, in fact, right? In the past 10 years-ish, in the past decade, the economic policy, certainly the monetary policy and the fiscal policy of vast majority of European nations would be equivalent in America to a very hard right, like Tea Party right, economically speaking.
Well, and how that ties in with the IMF, I mean, one thing I would say is that the IMF I would say they're deeply integrated at, like, say, the level of colleagues with the ECB. Mm. You know, they're contemporaries, a lot of them, they went to school together.
Probably, right?
So basically, the ECB in the last 6 months, they've gone all out with their quantitative easing, and the IMF is now just saying, well, this is probably what you have to do.
Mm. Yeah. The IMF was already making noises when the whole Germany versus Greece story that we spent some time talking. The IMF was the voice of reason, funnily enough.
Ironically enough.
Yeah.
Right.
They were calling for debt forgiveness. They were calling for changing the terms of the outstanding debt.
They opposed completely the austerity policies that Germany was trying to get on Greece. Right?
And then look who comes in. It's the World Bank is the one that ends up, you know, pushing all the buttons over in Greece.
Hmm. Right. Right. I mean, these are very politicized institutions, that both the IMF and the World Bank, different, but part of a...
But
of
ironically,
a
I think that was the World Bank who usually was advocating for more rational policies
for the most part.
I mean, if you look at their track record, for the most part, the World Bank tends to adopt policies that are poverty reduction and so on. And
at least that's what they call them.
Yeah,
that's how they brand them.
Of course, but that's what I'm saying. That in the Greek case, I think that those roles got reversed, right? In the sense that the IMF was the one actually saying, "Hey guys, we need to do something."
It's new ground for the IMF and the World Bank. They're used to, you know, pillaging poor, weak countries. That's their job. That's what they were created for, and that's what they've been doing. Mm. All of a sudden, you're tasked to attack within the European Union. That's kind of... It probably weirds them out a little bit. They're not used to it.
They probably have to wonder... No matter what worldview you have, you got to assume that the people in the IMF and the World Bank, they have to wonder who's next.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
I mean, if they've had to go through this with Greece, mm-hmm. I mean, is Spain next? I mean, Spain is certainly in the sights.
You could make like an amazing TV show about that contest, I think. It would sell. You know, who's next in terms of oppression?
Economic assassination.
Yeah. Well, find it in the map type of deal, a game show or something like that. Mm-hmm. But Spain and Portugal actually don't look very
much
well.
Much bigger economy.
Italy.
Yeah. And Italy, we're already...
Well, I mean, supposedly Italy's banks, I mean, I follow the financial news relatively closely. Supposedly Italy's major banks are more or less completely insolvent. Mm. And, you know, Italy's a fairly large economy.
Isn't it seventh now, or...?
It's somewhere
around there,
somewhere up there. So I mean, it's big.
Yeah.
So what they want to do in Italy is they want to do what's called a good bank, bad bank, which is, I mean, it's kind of bogus. But what they do, the idea is that you basically take bad loans and you just offload them into a new entity and you recover whatever you can recover, and then eventually you shut it down. And basically, what happens is that bank, some government entity becomes the depositor, right? So in this case, I mean, I'm assuming it's the Italian government would be the depositor in the bad bank, but all they're allocating is something like 10 billion euros.
Mm. But the way they're just like redistributing like toxic funds type of deal into...
What they want to do is they want to take the bad loans, which, I mean, where you draw the line on bad loans, I'm sure is very subjective, right?
Yeah.
They just want to take them off the bank, off the balance sheets of the major banks. More or less a swap arrangement. And, they more or less become, those deposits would then, the deposits backing those loans would then basically become the liability of the Italian government.
So basically it's like nationalizing,
nationalizing, but without the benefits to the public of nationalizing, because of the healthy banks are still private. Right, the banks that would still loan into the economy.
Isn't that basically like a sophisticated name for bailing out the banks?
Yeah, yeah, that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
That's basically it.
Yeah, that's it.
And that's what happened here.
To an extent, yes. Yeah, the Federal Reserve.
A little bit less. Like, what would
because
be
it
the
didn't
difference
even open
between that case and the bailout of the bank?
Because here we
in
didn't open
US
anything. We just had a secret stress test. We didn't do, I mean, this is more like what Reagan did in 82, maybe.
We rewrote, yeah, with the SNL crisis.
You nationalize it, you look at the books, you see what's worth keeping and
it's
what's
exactly
such a trash,
what
and then you restructure and reset and privatize.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's true. It is a bailout in the sense of like what Corey's saying, that the bill for the mismanagement, the mistakes,
it
whatever you want to call it.
It lands on the public's feet.
It lands on the public. Mm-hmm. Here it landed on the public too, but without even restructuring anything. So we just paid the bill and allowed them to continue unabated the same thing.
Now, like, I wonder who will own the new banks in Italy, if it'll be the old bankers.
Well, it'll still be the existing management.
That's a better deal if you're a banker, you know what I mean?
It'll still be the same people, still be the same management, the same institutions, the names won't change. The only new banks, if you will basically be zombie banks. Mm. They won't exist in a building. They won't exist in any form of infrastructure. They'll just exist on paper. And those will be the banks owned by the government, and they will be the banks that allow the bad loans to run off. They'll try to recover whatever they can from them.
Hmm. I wonder if we'll have vulture, the investigative journalist Greg Palast called vulture capitalism. The people that purchase poor country debt that has been discounted.
Oh, like what, a firm out of New York that just did that out of Argentina, right? That was actually just resolved today in court. Argentina can finally sell, bonds on the open market. They came to a resolution with the holdout.
They were forced to compromise it since there's a new government in Argentina that is,
They
bank friendly.
By the way, has anybody kept up with
bank friendly?
The only polite term I could come up with in short notice.
Does anybody know what
they definitely have a sense of humor?
Does anybody know what's going on with Brazil with the bailout there?
Well, that's
the bailout,
not a
the impeachment,
bailout.
The impeachment.
That is Rousseff. Quite. I mean, like there is. I was reading upon it actually today for a little bit because I think it would come up and. Basically, it's a very similar case to the Guatemalan case, right? Where Petrobras basically has some corrupt dealings with
Fernander. In Guatemala.
There was evidence in Guatemala. The problem with Brazil is that the media is actually really strong in terms of who owns it, and it's a very rich elite who actually is against the working party, which is in power, party from Da Silva, right, and the current president.
Yeah.
So the idea is that what the article was basically getting at was that there is still no evidence of linkages between the current president and Lula into the new corruption scandal, but the hype that the media is creating, because media is owned by right-wing elites in Brazil, has created a problem in which the Brazilian people, 68%, believe that the president, Rousseff, should be impeached.
68 public opinion now?
Yeah, so there you go, power of propaganda and media. And the problem is that, like, the catch is, the big question you would ask is the same question I always ask when I talk about corruption is, if the president was a right-wing president, would he be scrutinized at the level that she's been scrutinized right now?
Of course not. I mean,
right? The supply side of corruption is the side of corruption we should always be silent about, because we don't want to offend the people, right?
Let me step on a plank, shall I, since I'm tenured? All right. Yeah, I mean, and why am I a little bit hesitant? Because I want to shout out, send my love, to all the many, you know, Brazilian and Venezuelan students, some of which are in my class, and I love you guys and gals. Oops, that was me. Sorry. But, yeah, it's mostly a racket. This whole notion about the scandals of corruption and lack of democracy in the countries that we don't like very much because they're not doing what we tell them to do is mostly a racket. Are there problems of corruption? Yes. Were they better before, when the oligarchs, when the lily white rich people were in charge of countries? And Argentina is not Venezuela, by the way, nor Brazil is Venezuela. Venezuela was nasty and sometimes, but there was nothing like the horror of Brazil and Argentina, the mass executions, torture, rape, horror of the same people that are now trying to come back into power through what can be defined as a soft coup.
Yeah, that's
using
pretty much
propaganda,
it.
Right. Foreign assistance, manipulating the economy, because when you're very rich, you can literally sabotage your own economy and then say, oh, look how bad the government is.
Mm-hmm.
That is happening in Latin America.
It's remarkable. I mean, Brazil's economy is very, very scary. I mean, when mass media is willing to use the D word, depression, right? Mm-hmm. Which we never used depression here in the United States, like in 08, 09 or, you know, 10. We never said depression.
Mm-hmm.
Openly, we're calling this current state of Brazil's economy a depression. I mean, mm-hmm. it is by every measure. In mm-hmm. a depression.
Well, I mean,
well,
yes,
as long
yes.
as you have higher unemployment than GDP is going down,
but
you
the
have
major,
a
but a lot of the very poor, not so much in Brazil. That was a bit of a failure in dealing with the very poor in Brazil. Certainly nothing like the relative success in Venezuela, which reduces tremendously the poverty rate for the poor. I'm talking in a poor country over the past 20 years. But the thing is that. Well, Brazil is, there was a lot of gains to lower middle class in Brazil and middle class over the past, over mm-hmm. the period where they changed into Lula and now, Dilma Rousseff, or his, protege, yeah. And they're attacking Lula too, which really, I mean, come
well,
on,
I
talk
mean,
about a moderate, gentle
a
guy.
A lot of
you
the
know?
Problems, if they would have happened, and if they
have
could
happened.
Find the evidence, would have happened while Lula was president. Not in the
right.
new presidency.
Though. So the context is important, right?
Yeah.
In the sense that people, young people today may be in Brazil looking around them and saying there's a lot of trouble. Yes, there are problems, just like in Venezuela and many other places, there are problems, but they totally forget that the story told by these new guys mm-hmm. of how bad things were before is utterly fake. So in fact, there was some achievements at different levels, and it's not the corruption that is the it's a problem, but it's not the source of the problem. Let me get even further down the plank, thanks to your prompt. In America, we do not tolerate treacherous media. We tolerate critical media, but we do not tolerate media funded by foreign enemies.
Right.
Domestic. Outright. No. Yeah. Well, okay, that's the most fair enough, right? Fair enough. Yes. I mean, I'm cynical with you, but, you know, that's less so. So this is an unfamiliar characteristic for us, right? When we have media, like in Venezuela, I know the details, the 2002 coup, assisted and helped by the CIA directly, was overwhelmingly run by the main media operations, the same place where most people in America get their news about Venezuela, literally editing film they took in order to tell a story that never happened. In the mm-hmm. 2002 coup specifically. Right?
I mean, I think
the way it didn't, when restored to power with the support of the vast majority of the population, certainly at the time, as well as the military, President Chavez, the late President Chavez, did not shut down that media. Didn't give him any trouble. Much later, after several kind of further cases like this, eventually there was some pressure. People like to talk a lot about how the oil industry were experiencing shortage in the country that produces oil. What incompetence by these people. They failed to mention that it was the management of the oil company that did it, and that's why he nationalized them, and lo and behold, oil flew again. Listen, there's plenty of blame to go all over the place, but that's a huge topic, and we should, again, go back to exploring it a little bit. All
I mean,
I
feel sad about, for example, the Brazilian case taking up the same nature as the Guatemalan case took, right? Because in Guatemala, we actually were able to, after right. protests and the scandals of the president and the vice president being involved in the line and people walking out to the Central Park for months, right? Finally, the president resigned and we got a new president, and he's someone completely different from a completely different background. He's a comedian, by the way,
yeah.
right? But, I think that the sad part of the corrupt, of any corruption scandal for me is always the fact that politicians are the ones who are blamed entirely. And I think that that is a really, really bad mistake people make when they talk about corruption. Because politicians act as the demand for corrupt funds. Who's the supply? Because no matter, I mean, like, it's like the position, right. The position
like
is going to
only
stay
the
there.
Drug user, but not the drug dealer.
Yeah.
In fact, celebrating
I mean,
the
think
drug
about
dealer.
It. If you were
in fact, taking the money from the drug user and giving it, the police confiscates the drug user, shoots him in the head, and gives the money to the drug dealer with a pat on the back.
Exactly. I think that the real big problem of any corruption scandal is what we need to be asking always, if we're interested about how does corruption impact economic and political power, is who's providing the funds? These are the people who we really be chasing after. I mean, the politician, you're going to change it, you're going to get a new president.
Right.
But if the supply of funds is still there, that new president is just a question of price. What's his price? And you, any corruption-driven institution will want to match that price and make that politician corrupt. You're going to put in jail one politician after another, but you won't fix the systemic problem, which basically is the complete neglect and blind spot of who is providing the funds to be corrupt.
You know, and talking about corrupt politicians, I'm sure you guys have been watching the Panama Papers.
Oh, yeah.
The Guardian has got a little synopsis here of what's going on. And the one thing that did stand out to me was the fact that U.S. is not mentioning this. But anyway, I'm going to go through it real quick so we get a couple of chuckles here, real, you know, for us. And
in U.S., we have it, we do it in-house in Delaware.
Right. So anyway, $2 billion leads all the way to Putin. It's kind of like split between his chalice and his daughter's, his daughter
so
got married.
So it's John Oliver covered this last night.
She got married in some huge, you know, hotel and stuff or resort, and they got some of it too. Pakistan's prime minister is on that one. So it's the ex-term prime minister and former vice president of Iraq, Petro Poroshenko, president of Ukraine. Alaa Mubarak, son of Egypt's former president, the prime minister of Iceland. Well, we know how that one ended up.
That's the only poor soul that's not going to get a free ride from Iceland.
And the UK. He must be laughing so hard about his game.
Wouldn't hang in Reykjavik.
And the UK, six members of the House of Lords.
Viking Justice, I believe, calls for a spread eagle.
Three former conservative MPs and dozens of donors to the British political parties have offshore assets. The families of at least eight current and former members of China's Supreme ruling body, the Politburo, and they have been found to have hidden wealth offshore. 23 individuals who had sanctions imposed on them, supporting regimes in North Korea, Zimbabwe, Russia, Iran, and Syria, have also been clients of Mossack Fonseca, which is the law firm that released the papers.
And that's just one law firm.
Exactly.
In one country, that's all right.
And of course, you can't leave sports out of it.
Yeah.
A key member of FIFA. FIFA.
Again, involved in a corruption scandal, eh?
Well, I mean, I think that's how, that's like the Olympics and everything. It's like, this is how it's done, right? I mean, that's expected.
But it's amazing to me that, this has been going on for a long time.
Oh, sure.
The thing is, nobody has really done anything about it. And like, you know, Putin and,
I mean, like, at least in Guatemala, Panama has always been seen like the place politicians retire to.
Right.
Like, since I'm a kid, you know what I mean? Like, oh, what happened to that ex-president? He's in Panama. And that one, in Panama. And that other one, in Panama.
I wonder if they're going to expose the ones here in the U.S. after the elections or right before it.
And in Europe, you have others, and there's some islands in the Caribbean. I mean, there are different things. But the point, perhaps, is like, what do you want? Ask yourself a question here for a second. Imagine aliens come down, right, in a spaceship and hand you a suitcase with, I don't know, $100 million. Let's be large.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to immediately rush off with that suitcase to the IRS? And you might maybe consider calling your accountant, getting an accountant, calling one,
and a lawyer, maybe.
Could you please minimize the amount that I need to pay for taxes? There's an issue of legitimacy, of course.
I also think that there is a relatively important question to be asked in these cases, because they talk a lot about the 11 million documents right now in terms of Panama's papers, mm-hmm. right? And when you actually look through them, yes, you have big corporations and big politicians and important people and FIFA and all those cases linked up with corruption scandals, right? Mm-hmm. But let's suppose you're a medium-sized enterprise in a developing country in Latin America. You employ 20 to 50 people. Right? And every single time you pay taxes, you get a scandal like the one you saw in Guatemala, yeah. where people are literally in government pocketing their taxes, traffic in your city sucks, you don't have any type of healthcare, you don't have any type of education. Mm-hmm. In fact, you need to pay for insurance of your own if you want to have access to this type of goods, because there is no any public alternative.
I'm sure many Americans feel that that's pretty familiar.
Who would like to pay taxes to a government that does not provide reliably the intermediate good mm-hmm. that your business necessitates to be successful? And I'm not talking about big corporations here. I'm talking about mid-sized, small enterprises. They are not motivated, and they will try to find ways to not pay taxes, because what they have seen in government when it comes to taxes is literally a black hole, right? Where the tax money goes away and it never returns and is stored in Panama by one of the politicians you gave the taxes to, right? So I'm not saying that small businesses should try to avoid taxes. What I'm saying is,
it's like a chicken and egg problem.
It's a chicken and egg problem, right? And in the main issue here is, when you're looking at the 11 documents, the 11 million documents, how do you disentangle which businesses are purposefully trying to exit the system and avoid taxes, and which businesses were excluded in the first place from the whole taxation regime, and which businesses were really not trying to avoid taxes, but actually trying to make a profitable enterprise in that country, right. which they could
it
not.
It'd be very difficult. You know, one
that
thing,
is the most difficult aspect of corruption, right?
When you have that sort of a document dump, I mean, there's no easy way to sort through it. You know, you can have your hit list, if you will, of, you know, current high profile people, and that might number in the thousands, and you can just do like a quick, you know, search through to see if any of it pop up. But other than that, I read a thing. It was very interesting. It was eye opening to me. An enormous number of U.S. Medical physicians, licensed medical physicians, doctors, right, were their names are found in the Panama Papers. Like an enormous number of doctors. And these are not super wealthy doctors. I mean, they do well, right? But, I mean, they're certainly by no means like multimillionaires. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is that they had set up these offshore entities to shield themselves from malpractice lawsuits.
Hmm. Well,
there's 214,000 of them.
Maybe an excuse a little bit.
No, because, I mean, there's a government, there's so many government entities here in the U.S. I don't know the name of it, but it's the government entity that, like, looks for consumer fraud. Mm. I don't even know which, it's not the Better Business Bureau. But
like frauding the consumer.
Something, I don't know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like the Better Business Bureau, right?
Just kind of come up like with an acronym here. Expo. Here's an Expo marker. The Expo group. But
sounds like somebody's been on sabbatical for a long time. Eh?
No, but they by their own measure, like 73% of malpractice lawsuits brought in the United States are groundless.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if that number's wrong, give it like a margin of error of like 10% either way.
It's not a lot of money, though. I remember when there was the arguments of the, about the health reform, like 2009, you know, it's like one of the arguments, for the cost of medical care in America was the whole argument for tort reform. So yeah, to block the ability to sue, right? It might be that there's issues in there. I'm not saying no, but it's not the reason why our healthcare is so ridiculously expensive. That's mostly profits for insurance industry, and pharma. It's like 3%, I think, of the cost. All litigations together.
I mean, I would be
volume wise.
I would be stunned if it was that low, because anecdotally, a family friend of by families. He's an oncologist, right? 35% of his operating expenses are malpractice insurance. 35%. I mean, that's a long ways from 3%. Yeah.
So it might be centralized, you know, in different things. I wonder, because you know how it is, the very big overall numbers are relatively, you know, captured.
The other thing is the insurance companies specialist. Too. I mean,
they're
the ones jacking up the price on those premiums. Yeah.
Well, and they've kind of gotten into like an interesting
spiral.
You have spiral.
To be insured as a doctor against that, no?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, you have to. Yeah, you absolutely
and in
have
fact,
to.
I've spoken with doctors that actually spend a lot of time in their day, not looking at patients, but filing all the legal things patient.
Right.
That's
right.
An administrative cost. Yeah. Again, dwarfing anything. The profits and administrative cost, right.
Mm-hmm.
Bureaucratic, as it were. So a lot of doctors, American doctors, putting their savings,
they actually weren't sheltering their income from taxes at all, because what they did with their money is it was just a round trip to shield it from malpractice, claims.
Right.
What they would do is the patient or the insurance company, instead of paying the doctor directly, they would pay the doctor's LLC, right? And that LLC was owned by a foreign company. And then that foreign company would then pay a management fee to the doctor here in the United States. So the doctor was still paying taxes here in the United States, right? But just not as a medical professional, as a doctor. They were paying as the managing member of a company that was located offshore whose revenue originated here in the United States, so that
is taxed less than salaries. But my point, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure how it works out. I mean,
one article.
It seems like a manager of a company that's getting like the revenues of the capital gains of some kind from his investment is has a lot of options where salary let alone wage earners, even salary earners, don't get, right? We never see that money. It's taken away before.
I just remember what I was going to say, Jesse, to your point about the insurance companies. You know, these insurance companies, in a way, they've become like enablers of what I'm going to call bottom feeders. Because a lot of lawyers have figured out is that they can make 5, 10, 15,000 with like, you know, a 50-cent stamp. Mm-hmm. They just say, my client has received some sort of harm, you know, we'd like to proceed.
And they do.
Oh, the attorneys. So, to that point, I almost wonder if you should set it up so that you can't have an out-of-court settlement. You have to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, that would be a better solution. In my opinion,
initially,
wouldn't it be like incredibly like expensive bureaucratically wise?
Initially, it would flood it would break the judicial system.
Yeah.
Initially. But I mean, I think in time, if you could make it through that somehow, what would it come down to is attorneys, when they look at a case, they would genuinely consider whether or not it's a real case or whether or not it's just a scam.
Well, they'd be much more careful because, the money that they would have to put out just for processing in the court system would be outrageous. So they would have to cherry pick their cases.
Right.
So it would stop that, you know, ambulance chasing, you know, and just settling for 10,000 grand for just a bumper.
Actually, the ambulance chasers provide, I mean, it's the only way somebody who's not wealthy can seek, you know, legal recourse pretty much. But they do give you really shoddy service. So in fact, they get way less money than you really deserve. Right. They get their fees. They're kind of a maximizing quantity business.
And it fosters the lazy culture of lawyers, basically.
But there is the effect of also a fear, by the way. There's a lot of behavior that is of companies, let's say, right? Doctors, right? That is not driven by actual litigation.
But by fear of litigation.
Right. And lawyers are very influential in America, and
moral
they act it up.
Type of, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I even remember actually seeing when I had a little stint in an industrial organization for a while, learning from some of the commentaries on my papers, people explaining to me how Americans are like, they're business, right? The Americans are way less litigious than we think. This might be, we're talking, you know, 10, 15 years ago at least, more. But people don't end up suing that much. So, I mean, I have a totally trivial kind of example of this. Note that skiing or snowboarding or whatever, if you're like grow up doing that stuff. Not so much anymore in Florida. Yeah, you know.
Surfing.
The mountains here are not that big.
There is like one mountain in in Orlando.
Yeah, on the way to Miami, there's a giant garbage.
Right.
I could ski on that, I suppose, if it's slimy enough. Okay, but enough gross jokes. You could probably be interesting to snowboard on that. We'll see.
I might be able to do it on my
51st birthday. So in America, you can't go off the trails in ski resorts. Right? Sometimes they will not groom ski pieces. I didn't learn to ski in America. You know, trails. They will leave it powder, right? So that people can enjoy deep snow or whatever. But you can't go past the line. In Europe, you have a little sign every 10 meters saying like, you should have full insurance, that extra euro that you get on the daily ticket. Because if we have to come get you in a helicopter, you can expect between 20 to 40,000 euro expenses. Yeah. So be aware. And everybody does whatever, right? When she was 8, passed the line to find fresher powder in Colorado. You know, she got into trouble with ski patrol, which was one of the most proud moments of my life.
Yeah.
I think even 6-year-old getting busted by ski patrol for going out into the powder. Pretty sweet. Hmm. But jokes aside, right? Because, you know, America, so how many you can't even sue for that because it's not allowed. You actually have to, when you get the pass, it says like, you're dead, we don't care, you know? well, you see what I'm saying, right? You're not allowed to go, but there aren't many people suing, yet the entire culture of a sport was adapted and significantly affected negatively, perhaps, just by fear of litigation. So there is that, the expectations of litigation that could change things.
It's also quite surprising in terms of how culture impacts this type of issues, I think. We're going back a little bit with the whole corruption deal, right? And this is something that I find quite surprising. The Americans have one of the lowest IRS monitoring in terms of frequency. Mm. And nevertheless, the amount of cases, at least on average, Americans see of tax avoidance is relatively low. The big question economists ask when you're reading papers on corruption or things like that is, why is it that Americans are not that corrupt? Now, my personal question would be, is that the same at every income level, right? Because I think that if you have low to middle income, you would fear the IRS.
It probably is different. I got audited
at high income,
for like 3 years in a row.
You're supposed to be like exempt. Like, if they audit you and they don't find anything, you're supposed to be exempt for a period of time.
They like me.
Oh. So they went on, like, ongoing so they spend a bunch of agents on trying to figure out if indeed you reported your, that few $100, right? But that is indeed indicative too, because like, Corey, you were talking about these thousands of doctors that are not really wealthy. Now, so what? They have like a million or two in the bank? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Nice. But again, this is not where the bulk of the tax evasion money sits.
Yeah,
but these are the people who will pay. In America, probably too. If there's any kind of liability in Europe, these are the people that get attacked. Those little rich.
In Guatemala, what ended up happening was that the people who got accused of the corruption case for the línea, the line the president had run up, were usually small size importers, either from India, the Middle East, or Asia, right? Any of the local domestic elite, none of those guys got caught. And I bet whatever that these guys were in charge of the line. You know what I mean? Like the president came out saying there is another line, there is a line too, and that line is composed by the national domestic elite, right? And those guys are untouchable, you know, like, those guys never show up in news. I mean, like, let's fire the president of Iceland, but where is the money?
That's a terrible mistake. I mean, I predict right now that means that given within 10 years, they're back.
Yeah. Not even 10 years. They never leave. It's just the next president is getting the next offer.
They stay behind as advisors.
Yeah.
You know, consultants. Yeah. That's the one thing I noticed in corporations. It's like they never go. They
stay there,
or they retire and then come back as consultants. Mm-hmm.
That's why I think corruption, especially when people talk about corruption in government, it seems to me like such a weird conversation to have, because everybody's like, yeah, it's almost like people get these weird, like, almost like fetishistic type of, yeah, we got someone in power down.
Yeah.
But you kept the system up. So what was the whole point?
And it's really the worst phenomenon in recent years, what you're describing here. It's just like, you know, I'm sure the majority of the people, of the young people in the Maidan Square in Ukraine a few years back really wanted change for all the good reasons.
Mm-hmm.
That does not change the fact that that regime change in Ukraine was a complete non-democratic sham run by oligarchs.
And now we know all the money went up in Panama.
He wanted his oligarchs to win the deal. You know, don't get me wrong. But Western, it wasn't about freedom. It was about Western Europe taking over Ukraine. That was about. And Libya falls under the same. So you hear the corruption talk primarily from people generally associating themselves with the right, because certainly in America, right, the right wing is kind of government skeptic. Mm-hmm. But I applaud them for being that.
Yeah.
But like you're saying, in most increasing cases, it's partial at best, and literally a propaganda manipulation device.
That's my problem, that maybe the answer is correct but incomplete.
Yeah.
And you're not going to fix the actual problem of incomplete answers there. You need to, like, make systemic change something real if you really want to address the issue. Otherwise, what's going to happen, man? You're going to change a politician, the next president, just get the next offer, and that's it.
But we've been raised to believe in individuals, right?
That's the thing, the power of choice.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. Who's going to save us? Trump or Bernie? You
know? Trump over Bernie.
Neither. You got to save yourself. Get organized and save yourself. Maybe they won't get in our way. But it's not like the person.
Yeah, that's tricky. And it makes you think a lot about the recent attacks on Hillary Clinton, right?
Mm.
One of the main measures they've been attacking her for is she's corrupted and she's also part of the establishment.
I've got something fantastic right here. I have an entire list of all of her, the speeches that she gave.
All right.
Going back to 2013.
Oh, like, okay, hit me.
So, all right, so,
dramatic reading.
Starting,
number one.
Starting in April. This is an arbitrary starting. April of 2013, Morgan Stanley, right? 225. By the way, every single speech she gives, it ends up being for 225,000, except for this odd one for 400 grand. Jeez. I guess there are some exceptions. Most of them are around 225,000.
Wow.
The whole thing comes out to $21 million in speaking fees, right? In other countries, they might call them bribes, but because these speeches are literally like 15 minutes long. She just shows
bribes
up.
Are legal in America.
Really? So it's not like even like she won't do like an hour.
No, this is like
monologue or something.
Show up 15 minutes, done, out.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go onto YouTube and see a lot of these speeches.
Okay.
It's more so just her complimenting the CEOs. So like, here's some of the companies.
I think I'd rather chew on glass, but
here's some of the companies. Lightbulb, Morgan Stanley. Deutsche Bank, Fidelity, Gap. I don't know why Gap's paying her, you know, 225,000. Well, yeah, literally it says Gap Inc. I mean, San Francisco.
What do you mean? What? Probably Bill Clinton is right now finalizing contract in Haiti. You know, I'm not even joking. That's the thing.
Apollo Management, Itaú, which is a Brazilian bank, right? Verizon, Sanford Bernstein, Goldman Sachs, Spencer Stewart, right? The Society for Human Resource Management. I don't even know what that is. Economic Club of Grand Rapids.
I know who they are.
Do you?
The Society for Human.
Yeah, okay, yeah. What are they? Enlighten us, Jesse. Because they paid her $285,000 for a short speech.
Really? Well, they're the organization that certifies people like myself who are going through HR programs.
Mm. Really?
To certify that you're a professional executive.
It's the prime
level material. It's the prime. It's kind of like saying APA.
Or, you know. Boston Consulting Group. Let's Talk Entertainment, which I've never heard of them. Maybe we should talk to them, though, because they paid her $250,000. Maybe they'll pay to syndicate the show. American Jewish University, Colbert Kravis Roberts, which is a big private.
Who's the 400,000?
American Jewish University? Never heard of the place.
Yeah. Well, here, Jewish United Fund, they gave her 400 grand.
Wow.
UBS.
For 15 minutes
APAC? APAC? How much APAC? That's the name.
National Association of Chain Drug Stores, American Society for Clinical Pathology.
Wait, where is this published, man?
I pulled this off Zero Hedge. But I mean, I've seen it elsewhere. I've actually seen it on Reuters. The CME Group, CB Richard Ellis, Bank of America, GE. I mean, I could name like the S&P 500, you know?
Basically all you need to do is to like pay a politician as a corporation $250,000.
What's interesting
like
is,
I like to say, not only are they bleeps, they're cheap bleeps too.
Hmm.
Considering the kind of billions that are opened by politicians for, you know, a couple of $100 in the election year, it's really cheap. That's how it was estimated a few years back now already. So at least 5-6, right? I think where they did the kind of econometric study on the rate of return for lobbying.
Oh, it's a fantastic
22,000%.
Yeah.
By far the highest rate of ever recorded for anything.
Yeah.
The most shady, horrific profitable practices in history don't even come close.
Wasn't the 99% was it that this way? Like General Electric, I think, pays way much more in lobbying than they do in any type of research and development nowadays.
I believe, I mean, you know, GE, I look at this every year. So I think we might be, we're in 16, so we might be on 7 years now. GE pays negative income taxes here in the U.S. They pay, I mean, it's one of the largest companies in the world.
Yeah.
Right? And if you look at, if you were to look at the IRS tax code, they basically have clauses more or less specifically written. You know, they have deductions built in if you're building a nuclear reactor.
But don't they make tanks though? Yeah. Don't they? Don't they make a lot of weapons and stuff like
only
that?
Only a student actually corrected me. I know I they're a major player, and a student corrected me in class, and then followed up on it in homework, which I love when students do that, by the way.
Yeah.
Because I said that they're majorly in part of the military industrial complex.
That's what I thought.
They're only 3% on their corporate website directly weapon manufacturing. The thing is that they don't really count all those turbines they make.
Yeah.
Right.
Do they?
That's what I thought.
Missiles,
jet
planes, tanks, and other things like that. As well as heavy stuff like nuclear and.
Well, they also, they do an enormous amount of contracting for like Sandia National Labs, right? What's the facility out in Nevada? The,
what's the Area 51?
No.
That's the one with the aliens, man.
It's Los Alamos. Los Alamos, right?
Yeah, no,
sorry for the bad X-Files imitation.
Yeah, right.
Everything's interconnected like that, so sure, and that's why, and they sit on the board of New York Times, if you wonder, you know, why when it comes to
foreign policy.
Have you
ever looked at one of those infographics where you see, like, the interconnected web of people sitting on the boards of some of these companies?
Yeah. It's a Java app. It's so cool, but it's kind of lingering. Somebody needs to fill it up. Users can set an account and fill up the info. It's called theyrule.org. Org or net? Okay. No, I think it's not org because I remember it's not what you'd think be org.
Theyrule.net.
Yeah, I remember it's the other one. But it's fun, but it's kind of, there's some nice maps already built in, but it does illustrate the incestuous nature, you know, and people are talking about those few tens of thousands of people or, you know, less than 100,000 that quote unquote run the world, not talking about wealth necessarily. But board of directors and, you know, each CEO sits on a whole, but many CEOs will then sit on several board of directors electing other CEOs. Mm-hmm. So there is that kind of precisely incestuous relationship in terms of the incentives.
Hmm.
You want to get you're on the board, but you're not keeping a close, tight eye on your CEO because you don't want him sitting on your board and your CEO to keep a tight eye on you.
Mm-hmm.
So we understand each other. A little bit like Corey was saying, it's often underestimated the fact that you went to school together with important people. In fact, that is why people go into a lot of effort and cost to go to Ivy League schools. Honestly, it's not like Harvard teaches you any more economics. Yeah. Maybe less. But you get very good students
in
there.
I have empirical evidence of that.
Well, yeah. Maybe
like,
you
get... With Vanderbilt, I can tell you their curriculum is not as rigorous as Rollins.
In some right, you know, right, exactly. And it's kind of well known. I remember already in public schools, like good public schools, like my alma mater, UNC Chapel Hill, we always like saying, like, we're just as good as them. I mean, even though we're ranked 30 or something and not one or two.
At the same time, it's so difficult to assess what an econ department, a good econ department is, you know, and see a lot of publications, you see a lot of, it's a lot of better teaching and history. Like pluralism comes into the question.
But one thing, contacts. Mm-hmm. If you go to Harvard Economics, by the time you're my age, you're personal friends with all the leaders of the world. Right? You know them. You partied with them. So that's a major importance that gives power. So that's maybe a good reason, if you will, for why people will go through the effort and the expense. And maybe to some extent we're a little, not of that league, of course. But it's one of the things that the more well-known institutions do. But I mean, the bottom line to me is that this is not it might be an individual ethic failure on behalf of those of us who are the most successful. To be honest, to realize, I like to quote Bill Gates on this all the time because he's a Republican and he keeps saying that, yeah, I couldn't do what I have done without all the public infrastructure that was made out of tax money. And so he's honest about that. But we cannot expect people to voluntarily pay taxes. So if we offer all these loopholes, if we are indulgent, if we attack those that we can catch and not those who really need to be disciplined, what do we expect, right? That's kind of the economic thinking in the sense that this is a systemic failure.
That's the weird part about what I was trying to get at, right? That in the United States, you would expect way much more people at the civilian average, the median household, right? You would expect them to be paying way less in taxes and trying to avoid way much more given the probability of being detected. Because those probabilities are actually really low for the U.S., and there is a cultural element of...
I think the danger is bigger, though. Correct me if I'm wrong. In America, it's a crime. It's criminal.
That's right, yeah.
In Europe, it's a felony or whatever. What's the difference?
Oh, no, felony's bad. No, I mean, that's what it is here in the U.S.
Okay,
it's a felony. Whereas it might just be like a civilian penalty in Europe.
Something along those lines.
But still, I mean, like, you would expect seeing way much more people comparatively to other countries.
I think to your
avoiding taxes.
To your point, like, if you were to go to the cultural element, certainly here in the United States, you have a general skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
And I would even say fear of government.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just part of the culture.
Right.
And I mean, to a degree, it could, that fear could, you know, sometimes you see that fear, like I'm going to say, it manifests Texas style, where everybody owns an assault rifle, right?
Yeah.
And they're ready to secede. And then, I mean, the fear can also manifest in the form
Wish
of like,
form of accountability.
Well, yeah, I mean, kind of all the good to Texans your point, out the fear is like, I might get caught by this big bad, you know, organization, and I've heard that being audited is hell. So
look, what I'm trying to get here is that the average American then is actually being responsible citizen.
Well, fear works then,
right? I think that taxes are necessary and public goods are necessary. So if fear works, then let it work. But let it work as in an equal. There is another one: equal opportunity fear.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Big corporations and the big tax avoiders as fearful of that institution as opposed to being complementary.
I think there's a bit of a semantics problem though, because of like what GE does. And it's not just, not to just pick on them because of all of the major companies.
It's actually the norm, right? Cool companies like Apple and Google do it too.
I mean, you know how rare it is? I can't think of the last time a major publicly traded company had any sort of criminal inquiry for tax avoidance, like criminal tax avoidance. I cannot think of an example. So what they do it's not criminal tax avoidance. What it is that they just lobby. They change
it's
the law.
It's illegal.
They
right?
change the law.
Exactly.
It's legal because they've changed the law, right? They've changed what you have to pay taxes
But for. It's legal specifically for them because I wish I could open. You see what I'm saying here is like, I wish I could open a shell company and.
It's kind of like the two ways of being a winner. Yeah. One is like, be the best at doing by the book, right? And the other one is change the book.
That's exactly right. What it is. They just change the book. A number of years now, I've actually been in the camp that we should just send corporate tax rates to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Literally send corporate, pick up the rest of it on the personal side because eventually it will flow through. Not that it always flows through, like every year.
But it'll be easier to catch too.
In time, it all flows through. Right?
No, it's, right. No, and it's true. I mean, the whole notion of...
So, I mean, because of then, I mean, you send corporate tax rates to zero. So, I mean, maybe in theory, you could say your capture rate's a bit lower, but at least from a functional perspective, literally every corporation is now on an equal playing field, right?
That's true.
Those smaller companies, the ones with 20 to 50 employees, right, who can't afford to lobby, who can't afford...
don't have the power.
If they are creative enough and tenacious enough, they can compete with the GEs of the world.
That's true. I actually like that idea. That's a really easy idea.
It depends how you do it, right? Because over the years, the notion of fair tax simplification, late Milton Friedman was the first person I encountered advocating that before it. So it's always alive and well. Often this is a point. It's considered a conservative point of view, and it could be, but it depends how you do it. If you just put it down to zero, I hear what you're saying, that anywhere they're not, the big corporations where the real money is, they're not paying, so it wouldn't make much of a difference, and the level of playing and everything. Of course, that would then require to pick it up somewhere else.
Pick it up on the person.
So you'd have to create a fair, transparent, precisely a simpler tax system, but not designed to cut taxes for the wealthy further.
I mean, like, you got cases like that. Say, for example, there is an awesome TED talk on income inequality who talks about the Japanese strategy versus the Swedish strategy of taxing people, right? Mm-hmm. In which basically I believe Japan has a very similar income across different citizens, right?
Relatively,
it's a very homogeneous income. So there is not much redistribution going on in taxes, right? While in Sweden, you have more disparate income, right? But the redistribution in terms of taxes is way much more stronger. And it all gets done at the personal income tax level, right? So I think the idea would be now, the question is, okay, how would a CEO be able to tweak the system?
To his benefit.
Benefit.
So the most immediate failing to my proposal of a 0% corporate tax rate is that, you know, let's just take a multi-million, let's take a hypothetical CEO, right, who makes $20 million a year and his living expenses are only $3 million a year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he could just keep the $17 million and he could just tell the company, well, I mean, put this in a retirement plan or some form of retained earnings within the company.
Mm.
So then that additional income in excess of his living expenses, right,
mm-hmm.
accrues.